Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Spoken Heard. My name is Susan Bobby Chase, and today I am thrilled to bring you Miss Megan Ford. How are you, Megan?
I'm doing great. That is some intense intro music you've got there.
Just a little jazz for your morning to wake you up just a little bit. And I know you've been doing some interesting stuff this past week as far as what you're into. And this next week you have some dates for performances coming up, do you not?
Yeah, I mean, there's always the Cantab Lounge over in Cambridge on Wednesdays. Today, actually, there's a semifinal bout that I'm in over at Lizard Lounge, and then there's a bunch of different competitions coming up over at the House Slam in Dudley Square, the new safe space venue started by Janae Johnson and Portia O. I love those guys. So, yeah, a lot of fun stuff coming up in the next week or two.
Excellent. You know, I hear so much of the time about the Cantab and the Lizard Lounge coming out of the Boston area. They must be enchanted places where people just do magical things because everyone has got such wonderful things to say about them, and they just keep coming up over and over and over. They must be spectacular venues.
I mean, the thing with poetry venues you always got to remember is that, like, the work is almost always great, and occasionally you have, like, those one or two poets that mess up, but you're allowed the space to do that, and then everybody just talks with you after about it, and we start a dialogue, which I think is probably the healthiest way to approach art at this point in time. And also, both of those venues are bars, which is a great way to experience entertainment.
What do you mean by they're ours?
I mean, both the Cantab Lounge and the Lizard Lounge are their primary source of income is selling alcohol. As Mumbo Man always says, they're not in the business of poetry, they're in the business of alcohol.
There you go. So as long as you keep people imbibed, things should be going well with the poetry scene in Boston.
Exactly.
It's great to have you as a guest, Megan. I've been looking so forward to talking to you, and I was hoping that I could talk you into right away here, reading us something of yours.
Sure. So over the last year, I've been working on this manuscript about trauma and survivorship and the nature of memory. And this is a contrapuntal that I wrote for that manuscript just recently. It's called Bring Me a Sword. And Solomon ordered, cut the baby in half. That way each of you can have a part of him. First Book of Kings, chapter 3, verse 25. I know the boy I've raised. The scar dimpling his chin a soft crater. His crooked smile, cockstrut, confident, found his way young, but I know how to sing a boy to sleep. Know how to sweat the nightmare like a fever. He's different now. Better. He can get better sometimes. I know the things they whisper about him, nothing they'll say to my face, but I remember a little boy pulling fruit from the vine, whole strawberries hidden for later, awash on a string of red, red mouth. I can count all the seeds that got us here, so take me down to hell. Let me rest for half the year, then give me back the sunshine. Give me back the boy. He was some flash of skin in the night, and my body, teeth meant for me, you know all the ways to the marrow, to the needle, the pills, the soft of others, how to suck the poison out like honey, how to never be another excuse at hiding all his ruin. If you pray, junkie, criminal, rapist, a mother's nightmare, she paints the walls with, brother, where have your hands been? Taking all the sweet that can grow in the dark of all the words we tuck under our tongues, counting down to the next silence, I know what blood tastes like when you bit down hard enough to make yourself a liar. If you must damn me for the truth, will you figure how to spin this story clean as cotton? Give me back the strength that kept me fighting and the knowledge that what he sees in the mirror is only half. Boy I've raised. He was some flash of skin in the night, the scar dimpling his chin, and my body a soft crater. His crooked teeth, smile meant for meat, cockstrut, confident, you know all the ways to the marrow. Found his way young to the needle, the pills, the soft of others, but I know how to sing a boy to sleep. How to suck the poison out like honey, know how to sweat the nightmare like a fever, how to never be another excuse, he's different now. Better at hiding all his ruin. It can get better sometimes if you pray. I know the things they whisper about him, junkie, criminal, rapist, nothing they'll say to my face, a mother's nightmare she paints the walls with, but I remember a little boy. Brother, where have your hands been? Pulling the fruit from the vine, taking all the sweet that can grow, whole strawberries hidden for later in the dark of all the words we tuck under our tongues, a watch on a string counting down to the next silence, a red, red mouth, I know what blood tastes like, can count all the seeds that got us here when you bit down hard enough to make yourself a liar. So take me down to hell if you must damn me for the truth. Let me rest for half the year while you figure how to spin this story clean as cotton. Then give me back the sunshine. Give me back the strength that kept me fighting. Give me back the boy and the knowledge that what he sees in the mirror is only half.
Just wonderful. I love your use of, well, there's some really hard imagery in there, and there's certainly some hard realizations in there. And I think that we should go there with it. I certainly don't want to make you talk about things that are painful, so please let me know if I'm getting too close. But
I write about this stuff all the time. If I wasn't going to talk about it, I wouldn't be bringing it here.
All right, then. Let's talk about where this came from.
Yeah, a thing that a lot of people, pretty much everyone close to me and now especially my family knows, is that I am a multiple trauma survivor, including a survivor of forced childhood incest. So the manuscript that I've been working deals with a lot of that and how someone's own memory can warp and create convenient plot lines and not false memories, but the way that, and everyone does this too, the way their memories work, how it'll shuffle things around, and everyone remembers things slightly different, which is a really interesting conversation I've had with my mother many times about how we both remember exact same situations differently. So what this one deals with specifically is my mother's story of my brother, my story of my brother, and then the two interwoven together. While also pulling from some of the Catholic imagery that I was raised with. So, first book of Kings.
So, your brother got himself in some trouble young, it sounds like.
Yes, my brother has had issues with alcohol and drugs pretty much since he was 16 years old.
Yeah, which I
think is something a lot of families go through. It's not easy for everyone. And then that creates this whole interesting cycle of dependence and savior complexes and how to approach family dynamics when there is emotional manipulation happening from all sorts of sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so many times during that, there's like this unwritten set of rules that pops up and everyone knows what they have to keep a secret and what they can actually talk about and how they can talk about it. Somehow, miraculously, without any words at all being said, there's just this whole construct for what is appropriate, whether or not that's healthy.
Yeah, no, it it really does create a fairly warped family dynamic as the things go on. And pretty much the reason this project has continued to evolve and grow is because I'm still living this story every day. I just had the big conversation with my parents just a little over a year ago. I didn't tell them for the longest time. Well, because also, one, repression is a thing. It is a very real true thing that then you have to explain to people how that works. And then the rest is just, I come from a very large, really close-knit family, actually. So how do you balance that sort of oppressive silence that happens with also trying to heal and be true to yourself in the wake of all of this? It's a very specific kind of grief.
Well, you know, you just mentioned that you had to talk about what repression means and how that
mm-hmm.
works. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So it was one of those things that the way post-traumatic stress disorder sometimes shows up in your life is that it just removes really traumatic experiences from your mind, but there's always this lingering impression of it in your body and just how you react to certain situations, and you might not know why you're having that overreaction to something that seems like a very small slight to other people until you start having dreams or memories of things coming back. And then, you know, you start to question everything, like, did this really happen? Am I making it up? Is it just dreams? Like, how do you separate that from the truth and how you
mm-hmm.
come to your own truth with your own personal narrative?
Right, right. Must feel awful to have to question yourself like that.
Oh, yeah, it's it's maddening. It really
no,
is.
No, I believe it.
And ultimately, you really just, you wind up having to trust yourself more than everyone else, which is
that's
a really
enough, right?
Yeah, it's both courageous and terrifying all at once.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe completely that that's true. It's just such a big hurdle to climb over for anybody who's gone through any sort of, well, you know, repressed memories of something that, of some sort of trauma that's happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
I look at my friends who have had similar situations and friends coming back from war, et cetera. I look at PTSD, and it's just so encompassing, so all, everything in your body reacts to it, but you try not to say it or let it be part of you, and yet it's there no matter what you do. So it's daunting.
And it does actually live in your body. There's a little joke that happened recently when I was at the Women of the World Poetry Slam in Brooklyn just back in March. I got to see my best friend, Melissa Newen Evans, who has since moved to Denver, Colorado. Hi, Melissa. And we were talking about the nature of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which the medical community is starting to recognize as someone who has gone through a series of traumas that now it lives in your body in a really specific way. Mine,
mm-hmm.
one of the really easy tells for this is how much tension I carry in the muscles of my shoulders. I have a couple of friends who have become physical therapists, and they're like, "Oh, you look like you're just cringing all the time." And they attempt to touch my muscles at all, and they're like, "Oh my God, this is a solid mass. How did you?" And one of my friends recently, she went to try to work the tension out of my shoulders and stopped and just went, "Oh, that makes sense." And I'm like, "Well, what does?" And she goes, "You have trauma shoulders." And I was like, "Excuse me, I have what?"
Wow.
She's like, "You." It's from complex PTSD. We call it trauma shoulders. I'm like, it has a name? It was somewhat infuriating, but also hilarious.
Yeah.
So I remember telling this story to Melissa, and she's like, "Oh, well, that's a poem. I want to hear the trauma shoulders poem."
Okay, I do too. You have to write one because I need to hear trauma shoulders too.
Well, so now I'm trying to do the combination of the two ways in which I write really well, which is trauma and survivorship and comedy, because I think comedy is a really necessary part of healing, actually, that sometimes
yeah.
just laughing about the complete absurdity of our lives is incredibly helpful. And in this one, I'm writing a funny trauma poem, which is a really interesting balance to have to strike.
Right, right. I bet it is. I bet it is. I can't wait to hear it. And I agree that sometimes shrouding what you have to say that's serious in humor can be so much more effective than being a bossy writer who just sort of like shoves your feeling at the readers. When you can write and have them make the assumptions for you, so much
mm-hmm.
more enticing as a listener, you know?
Oh, I completely agree. It's one of those poems that I know it's going to take a while, and it's also the strangest structure I've ever had to put for a poem, because at the Cantab Lounge, they have what is known as the Cantab Turn, where a poem might start funny or somewhat lighthearted, and then about halfway through, it just turns really hard into
yeah.
the serious poem and catches you off guard, and everyone's like, oh, right in my feelings. So this poem like has a really late turn, and I've written the turn. I know where it needs to go, but now I also have to plan out like something of a comedy routine. I need to plan out the jokes I have at the beginning and hope that I'm not crossing the line of where comedy and trauma and healing to possibly making people feel uncomfortable. Like it's one of those like, this is a really delicate balance.
Right.
Because they're, but also, like,
yeah.
I come from a family of very dark-humored people, so.
Well, that's probably helpful.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
no,
apparently. Well, so we're about halfway through the show, and I was hoping that I might be able to get you to read a second piece.
Oh, sure. So this is another one. I'm known as having a bit of a bummer train, if you will. This one. Yeah, I've actually called feature sets the bummer train and explained different stops that we're taking on the bummer train. I'm not even sorry. this is another one from the manuscript. It was published in a Sweet on Nailed magazine last year. It is called 19. Did you know an abortion costs $245? Mind you, stepping out of the poem for a minute, when I wrote this was a decade ago, so that should now actually be updated to $600. So, did you know an abortion costs $600? I paid for my sister's second because we are all scared and poor in our own way. It was the same year a doctor told me that my belly would not be a home. I told my mother I didn't want children, but all she heard was, I don't want to be you. I stopped telling her stories. This was the year I decided you didn't count, that virginity is not something that could be taken from you. This was the year science failed me, and someone said maybe your trauma damaged my cervix. Maybe that was why everything else inside me feels rotten. This is the year of not, the year of undoing. This is the year I ran away, and I'm not sorry. I found my heart in the crisper drawer with the red peppers and other red fruits. It wants to know when I'll be using it again. I wash it under the tap to get rid of the smell of old meat, dress it up in fresh plastic, and hide it away behind the icebox cake.
Mm.
Bummer poem.
The bummer train.
The bummer train.
There's some gorgeous imagery in there.
Just like I said,
imagery.
I'm very sarcastic. Thank you.
And I love that about you. I really do. Is this part of the manuscript that you were talking about writing?
This is part of the manuscript. So it is set up, structured as a choose-your-own-adventure-style book of poetry about trauma survivorship and the nature of memory. So it is a bit of a gimmick to have it as a choose-your-own-adventure book of poetry, but it is specifically set up that way to show the different loops in which memory can take and come back on itself and change and warp. And then I've actually even included an intentional loop in there that you about getting stuck in the same cycles of behavior and how abuse and emotional manipulation, how that can happen. It starts with the poem. That loop starts with a poem called When the Dog Dies. Because it was a running joke in my family for a while that my dad always said that I, before they knew everything, he was like, when that dog passes, she's never going to come home. And I was like, he's not wrong. Because, you get like, just complete love from animals that humans are not capable of giving you.
Right.
Just unabashed warmth.
Yeah. And nothing changes it. You know, it seems like it's always there. Yeah. And they're so happy to see you when you come home. And
This
wonderful, wonderful warmth that, well, at least my dog can give me. So it's there for everyone. Yeah, so, you know, I know that you're a friend of Write Bloody and that you've gotten other things published in anthologies, G's, and whatnot. Is this manuscript is for your own piece now? your own chapbook? Is it a book?
It started out as a chapbook. The tentative mm-hmm. title is Wild Hurt. It's gone through just so much growth over the last year and a half because I started writing it leading up to having the conversation with my family, and now having a year of growth and healing and backtracking and stumbles with all of that, it has just mm-hmm. continued to grow as the story happens. That is my life.
right.
So it has started out as a much smaller piece, and now it is definitely a full-length book, and I'm trying to find a home for it while also finishing the last few poems. So really, really, I just need to continue cracking away at it and finding a way to tell the story without that being the only story, because as a human being, like, yes, that is a very large part of my life, but it is not the only part of my life, which is
right.
something that I need to continually remind myself in writing.
Yes, I agree. I mean, we can get into these loops where we just blow in the same sort of narratives, the same set of feelings, because they're so strong and really
mm-hmm.
so valuable. But when we do that and we get stuck in that little tiny microcosm, there are so many things about life that we miss with the bigger picture. And,
exactly.
It's so difficult to be a writer like that, because you want to, right? You want to hone in on that one moment in time. And to be able to do that is such a gift. But then to be able to then expand your view so you're looking at the world at the same time is just,
mm-hmm.
you know, incredibly difficult. And I don't think that a lot of writers just understand that poetry is as hard as any other longer form of writing, because you have to be so adept at those little things. It's like taking pictures. I mean, there are some excellent pictures, but what they're doing is saving that one moment in time, personally and universally. And I think we do the same thing with poetry.
Oh, I completely agree. And then also my master's is in creative nonfiction, which is probably why so many of my poems pull from my own life experiences, because I've just begun instead writing nonfiction poetry. I just combined
it. Well, it's
got to
be cheap therapy too, you know what I mean?
Now I finally have started working within the mental health industry to get help and more tools to figure out my life with. Like now I get to write funny poems about my therapists.
Well, that's good. That's excellent. I'm really glad to hear it. Are you planning on, I know that you said that you went to the Women of the World Poetry Slam this year. How did that go for you?
So I did. I did not get to compete. Well, technically, I did. I got to compete in the Last Chance Slam, which was a bloodbath. And the woman who won it, Honey Sanai, actually wound up on final stage. She was such a her poems were gorgeous. They were actually heartbreaking. She was such a kind woman. It was really great to see that happen. So I got to do my favorite poem to a room of people who had never heard it before, and then casually enjoy the rest of the time hanging out with my friends and cheering for them as loudly as my rather impressive lungs are capable of.
Nice.
I'm a very small person. No one thinks I am going to yell as loudly as I do, and then I prove them wrong.
Way to go, lung. Just call you lung for the rest of the time.
Well, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. I'm one of three. My parents are my mom's one of eight. My dad's one of six. If you're not loud in my family,
wow.
you just don't get heard.
Yeah, it would seem. Wow, both from huge families. And then when they got together, do you have a lot of brothers and sisters as well?
So I have one brother and one sister, both of whom are older than I am, and I have 47 first cousins.
what a lot of family.
Yeah, and I specifically don't friend family on Facebook, because that's not what I use that social media platform for. So
right.
every now and then my mother will get a call from a cousin or one of her sisters, one of my aunts, and be like, Megan hasn't accepted my friend request. And I'm like, and I'm not going to. You can tell them I have friended absolutely no family members, and I will not. I'll see you at the holidays.
Wonderful. Right.
If you
want
to talk to me, call
all
me.
Your time on all your time on Facebook just with your family alone, otherwise, right?
Yes, seriously. Oh, I can't.
So I'm reading here on your bio, and I'm not sure what exactly this means, that you're the very first individual NUTS champion. What's that mean?
Yes, it was the Northeast Underground Tournament Slam, the acronym of which is NUTS.
NUTS.
Because Manchester, New Hampshire Slam for Your Dive venue has a sense of humor, and I love them for it. they have started an underground team tournament similar to NUPIC that happens at Nationals each year, where you, instead of individuals, you do pickup teams. And last year they had an individual competition as well, which I happened to win and actually paid for pretty much my entire, I'm not sure if it was IWIPS or RAWIPS that it paid for. I'm trying to remember the timeline. It's probably RAWIPS. No, it must have been IWIPS last year because I didn't go to WOW. And Janae Johnson won last year, and I did not get to see her do it. But yeah, no, it was
super
fun. No, I'm just saying it was super fun.
You've also been at IWIPS, you just said. Have you competed at the individual slam?
Yes, I've competed at both of them, just so I only got to compete at IWIPS this last year, whereas WOWIPS, like, tried to storm, tried to venue rep, and, like, didn't make it through every single time. There were so many people there this year because it was in Brooklyn, and it's just a gorgeous tournament. And IWIPS, which was in Washington, D.C. this year, was so much fun. I had such a good time, and everyone in D.C. was so welcoming and would, like, give you rides to venues even though they didn't know who you were at all. They were so kind and so welcoming. Both of those tournaments were so incredibly well-run this year. It was really fun and impressive.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to get that feedback. Kudos to those people who are listening who were involved in that. That's a fantastic thing to hear. It really is. That's the kind of community that I think that Slam Fam has definitely evolved into during the best of times, and I think we need to hold on to that instead of, you know, I think that we are a group with a lot of strong feelings because we have to be, and because, you know, that's what's made us successful. When we get together, sometimes it can be a little overwhelming, but then there are times like this where everybody, you know, is just kind and so welcoming that that's something I have to remember during the times when things get a little dramatic, I guess.
Oh, yes. And you just make so many friends at the individual competitions. In team slams, you can wind up stuck in your own thing because your team is together and you need to compete and, like, you've already made your family for that summer. But in indies, everyone's there by themselves, and you wind up creating, like, I remember the chant at at IWIPS with Squad, and people who, like, you had never met before were cheering for you because they heard one poem that they loved, and now you're best friends.
Right. You know what? I hate to say this, Megan, because it's been a wonderful show, but I've got just enough time to have you read us out. I wanted to mention that my guest next week is Jillian Christmas, and I am looking forward to that as well. But one last time, Megan, could you read us something to get us out of the show?
Absolutely. And we're gonna end with some humor, everybody. And also definitely come back for Jillian Christmas. I love her. She's awesome. I'll be listening next week. So this is one I wrote just this last weekend because this just happened to me 2 weeks ago. Okay. It's called Accident. People say they're accident prone. They mean, I'm so clumsy. It's charming. Lol. When I say I'm accident-prone, I mean that I expect to die in a genuinely unique way. Something you haven't seen since the Dark Ages. Maybe I'll contract the plague from that rat I drop-kicked into the bushes in Alston. Or perhaps I'll get run over by a horse and cart and dragged for several blocks as it carries newlyweds through downtown. My most interesting injuries have all been accidents. Bruised ligaments and a concussion from slipping in a puddle while carrying an armful of apples. broke all of my fingers except my thumbs at the same time, trapping them above my head because I climbed into the back of my dad's truck to get a blanket and shut the door behind me. The story of my most recent facial scar is one that I will never be able to tell without it sounding ludicrous, because it fucking is. Everyone asks if I was drunk, like, it will forgive me. I wasn't. So, I was in the St. Patrick's Day parade, dressed as a Ghostbuster, because I'm a goddamn adult, and while giving a little girl a spectacular high five, I promptly tripped in a pothole and ate shit, splitting my chin, requiring 5 stitches, bleeding all over myself like a horror movie, and definitely traumatizing said child. I doubt she will ever ask for a high five again. What I'm saying is, I'm looking into human bubble protection. I'm checking exactly how much my new insurance at work covers. I'm writing a will in the event of my unexpected, entirely expected demise. I am planning my ridiculous departure from this world in the only way it will allow me. Random and full of fire.
There you go. Megan Ford with a wonderful comedic piece to end things off. Again, Jillian Christmas next week. I'm Susan Dobie Chase. This is Spoken Heard. Until next week, be kind to one another.